on Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the State House fast-tracks its minimum wage bill, trying to torpedo a petition drive campaign.
This group, Raise Michigan, is going to be turning in their petition signatures tomorrow to the Secretary of State, and that's one of the reasons why this is happening so quickly.
Plus, why are GOP lawmakers trying to block that second bridge to Canada?
I don't know why the people in power here aren't doing more to make this happen.
As Michigan's powerful gather on Mackinac for the annual policy conference, one group asked, what about those who can't afford the $2,700 ticket?
They're talking about the future of Michigan at Mackinac, but we really believe that they haven't done a really effective job of incorporating the actual future, which is, you know, younger voices.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. Governor Snyder wants it, big business wants it, and Canada is willing to foot the bill for it. So why is the new bridge between Detroit and Windsor being sidetracked by politics in Lansing and foot-dragging in Washington? I'm Cynthia Canty. Also today on Stateside, a new study finds female parolees and probationers who live in poor, high-crime neighborhoods lack the support systems those in more affluent areas have. How does this impact their chances of winding up back in prison? But first, the State House is now the chamber taking up a proposed increase to Michigan's minimum wage. As we know, last week the Senate gave speedy approval to its minimum wage measure. Well, now the House is giving fast track to a version, and both are designed to kill off a citizen petition drive to put the question of raising the minimum wage to $10.10 an hour on the November ballot. What do Michigan voters think about raising the minimum wage? Kathleen Gray is a political reporter for the Detroit Free Press, and she joins us now from the state capitol. Kathy, spell out, if you will, the major differences in the House and Senate versions of the minimum wage bill.
Well, there's three main differences. The Senate passed it up to $9.20 an hour and to $3.50 for tipped employees like bartenders and waitresses. And they also linked it to the rate of inflation, so it could go up even higher if inflation increased. The House version stripped out the inflation and set it at $8.50 an hour for traditional hourly employees, and 38% of that would be for tipped employees, which would come out to $3.23. So there's some pretty big differences between the two bills.
But I'm gathering the similarities between the two is that this House bill, just like the Senate bill, is trying to render that ballot question to raise the rate to $10.10 an hour moot, correct?
Absolutely. Both of them repeal the current state law. So this group, Raise Michigan, is going to be turning in their petition signatures tomorrow to the Secretary of State. And that's one of the reasons why this is happening so quickly, is because they'd like to get this law passed and signed before they turn their petition signatures in. And that may end up with the issue not even being able to be on the ballot because it is addressing an issue that isn't there. Because the Raise Michigan Coalition is trying to change the existing law, which this new bill repeals.
But we know, as you say, they're going to go ahead, they're going to turn in those signatures. Could we see a court fight?
That's a possibility. It's an expensive proposition for both sides. And I'm not sure, you know, if either side wants to spend the money on this, or if they want to spend the money on helping candidates get elected. Mm. So it's kind of a big mess right now. I think what might happen, though, is if the House version passes, it will lose all the Democratic votes that it got in the Senate. And then the Republicans would have to conjure up six or more votes from Republicans who voted against it when it passed in the Senate to come on board with this version.
Is that likely, do you think, Kathy?
You know, I think it's a possibility because there was a lot of things that people were upset about, this 920 bill, that it was linked to inflation, that it raised it up to 920 instead of the 815 that was initially proposed. So now that it's backed off a bit, I think that they might be able to get some Republicans on board and it, you know, might be able to pass with just Republican votes.
To make up for the Democrats who are going to walk because this knocked out
right.
The indexing
right.
To inflation and the higher rate.
Yep.
The Free Press had a very, very interesting, your story in the front page of the Free Press, which I was reading over my morning coffee, was real interesting. You did a poll, and with this new polling data, asking questions about what do voters want and also what they think of this Republican tactic of trying to blow the petition drive out of the water. So talk first of all, but what did you find in terms of what voters think overall about raising the minimum wage?
Well, there was the most support for the 10-10, raising it to 10-10 per hour. That was like 56 to 36, so that had really very strong support. There was a majority support for the 9-20 per hour, but it was a much closer margin for that. I think it was like 49, 46, somewhere around there.
Mm-hmm.
And the one thing that voters really didn't like is the way the Republicans were going about doing it and it blowing the petition drive out of the water. They were opposed to that pretty significantly, with only 29% supporting that tactic, and I think it was 56% opposing it. So, you know, voters are pretty smart. They see what's happening, but they may not be able to vote on it in November if this gets through and as it's being proposed today.
What, as you say, even among Republican respondents, people did not like this tactic. Could this have any kind of repercussion come November when it's time to vote?
It could. Republicans are going to come out and vote for their candidates no matter what. Democrats are going to come out and support their candidates no matter what. What it might do is fuel some support from people who are really mad about this. And those tend to be Democrats, independents, women, and African Americans support the 10-10 minimum wage in much higher percentages than other voters out there. So it could fuel some turnout either way, if it's on the ballot or if it's forced off the ballot, despite the fact that these folks went out and gathered more than 300,000 signatures to get it on the ballot. So it could fuel some turnout.
And isn't the GOP trying to, you know, to bring more folks into the fold, such as African Americans and independents and women? So if they're trying to court these groups this election season, it's not going to help them.
Not with this issue.
Yeah.
They're considering raising taxes on gasoline and doing all sorts of things and not providing the highest minimum wage proposal that's out there. So I think there are certain groups that will look at that and be pretty upset about it.
And as your piece in today's Free Press pointed out, you spoke with Bernie Porn, who's president of Epic MRA, who did the polling.
Mm-hmm.
The Republicans just don't want this on the November ballot any way, shape, or form, right? This minimum wage question.
That's right.
It is lose-lose if they have it on the ballot.
Because it could drive higher voter turnout, and it's primarily Democratic voter turnout that it would get. And if it's on the ballot, it's going to drive turnout. If it's not on a ballot, then the group that went out and got all those petitions, they're going to turn their efforts towards increasing turnout.
What are you watching for going forward? I know there's a lot of you know, things moving in Lansing today, but going from this and then looking ahead into November, what do you think will happen? What should we watch for?
Well, I think that this minimum wage is also tied to the road funding package. Democrats are saying, hey, you know, if you're not going to give us anything on minimum wage, then we're not going to give you anything on road funding. So it's, you know, everything is tied together up here, and it's all tied together with the election. So, you know, Republicans are playing to their base, Democrats are playing to their base, and it just depends on who is more successful on getting their voters out based on all these issues. And there's a lot of issues to play with this year.
Well, it is interesting to look at the results of this poll and get the clear sense that voters in Michigan favor raising the minimum wage.
By a very large margin too. It's you know, not small and middling, and people are pretty much decided on it. There was only 5% undecided on the 10-10 per hour question. So you know, that people are feeling pretty strongly about it.
Did that surprise you? Did that level of support surprise you, Kathy?
You know, other polls that have come out on this issue have shown around that level of support. Some have been higher, some have been lower. But no, I'm not surprised by that. I was a little bit surprised that the 920 per hour wasn't supported in a larger margin. And, you know, voters might end up getting real confused about this, too, because there's two different proposals out there. When we asked voters which one they preferred, it was evenly split. So I think that there is a confusion factor out there, too, that's unfortunate.
But it doesn't seem people are confused about this strategy that the Republicans are using to...
No.
doesn't seem to be a lot of confusion there. People don't... they're holding their nose, aren't they?
No, and you know, another one of these came out today with the Wolf proposal. A third Wolf proposal was that turned in their petitions today, and that may end up on the ballot, or again, the legislature might take that up and pass it and nullify the other two anti-Wolf proposals. So it's certainly a tactic that's gotten a lot of action this year.
Detroit Free Press political reporter Kathleen Gray, who joined us from the Capitol in Lansing. As always, thank you so much, Kathy.
Thanks, Cynthia.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. There's a new effort underway to help the families of Michigan inmates cope with having someone they love in prison. It's a pilot program that centers on having someone serve as a liaison between prisoners' families and officials at three Michigan prisons. And the woman running this new program brings some pretty hard-earned insight into what it's like to have a loved one behind bars. Lois DeMott's son was a prisoner. So she learned for herself the difficulties of trying to navigate the prison system. And now she's hoping to help other families with the new Family Participation Program. Lois DeMott, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
Your son was sent into the adult prison system at age 15. And I have to say, as a mom, too, it would be so understandable if you decided to detach yourself from anything to do with prisons. And yet, there you are, the co-founder of the group Citizens for Prison Reform. And now you're launching this Family Participation Program. Why so involved?
Well, I certainly believe that our family members are with us forever, and I believe in unconditional love. Certainly, it was not an easy road, and it wasn't an easy choice, and there's a lot of pain and anger and a lot of emotions that go along with all of that. In some senses, you somewhat become a victim yourself. The family does. There's a lot of toll that it takes on the family, but I knew if my son was going to ever see himself through to the other side, that he was going to need to feel support. And that is something that is not readily available on their own from the inside. And so not just myself, but my entire family made that decision that we were going to stick by him through thick and thin. And once we got inside the system, you know, we were told by the judge the day that he was sentenced that he would receive the services and the help that he needed on the inside. And I believe that the moment of truth was once he was actually moved to the inside, and we saw that far too often those helps are not in place for those that are on the inside.
So as you're launching this new family participation program, what will you be doing? Give us examples of the kind of ways that you can help family members and in turn help the inmates.
So currently I am working in the three pilot prisons. I have one of those prisons that's kind of the lead setting up the program. We have found five family liaisons or advocates who will be volunteering. I have a training program that I am putting together currently. We will be working with the liaisons to make sure that they understand all of the resources that are available. And there are two primary places where those resources are coming from. One is from a resource guide that Citizens for Prison Reform, the organization that I co-founded, put together, and that is available on their website. There is also a link to it currently on the Family Participation Program website. And the Michigan Department of Corrections last year also put together a family informational packet that is now available on their website. Many families are just not aware of the simple fact that there are these resources out there.
And does it take someone like this liaison who is been through it and understands better the ins and outs to be able to take somebody by the hand and help guide them?
Yes, I certainly believe that it does. You know, you go into the system, and what I found is that once I got inside, you know, there were staff that were very helpful. There were staff that we look back on and we give tremendous thanks to that helped us. But those people are overwhelmed with the number of calls that they get. They're easily frustrated. They have families that call who are angry, who are upset, and I used to be one of those families. It's very difficult for the staff there to be able to handle sometimes the other side of this, which is the family's emotions. They're overwhelmed with not knowing where to get the information from. And so family-to-family support is huge. Support of someone walking alongside you that's been through it and can help navigate is certainly crucial in this role.
Lois, what kinds of services and what kinds of information are families looking for and are you helping connect them with?
Well, you know, up front, families find out that their loved one's going to the system and you immediately begin to panic. You don't know how you're going to be able to contact them. You don't know how visitation works. Are they going to be able to talk on the phone? Knowing how to set up all of those things is a first step. And it really lowers a family stress within their family unit. If they have this information and they're able to move forward, they're able to communicate that with their loved one that they have these things in place. There are simple things. There was a woman who called. Her son had been in for 7 years, and she didn't know that she could order books. So for 7 years, he had not received any kind of reading materials because of the fact that she didn't know. And that's something that is available on Michigan Department of Corrections within their policy. Mm. But a person has to know how to navigate those policies and be able to look that up. So all of that information is in the Citizens for Prison Reform Resource Guide, those crucial first steps, some of the most important things that families need to know, that there's a recipient rights for the mentally ill, a specialist who works within the system. Granted, there's only one for the entire system, but there are these avenues in which families can receive the help that they need and try and work through issues if they come up. And of course, what we want to do is, number one, help the prisoners to become as independent as possible. There's processes that they need to go through themselves to navigate the system where possible, but there are prisoners who are not able to do that. And so the goal here is to assist families in learning how to do this work for themselves, for them and their families to step up and to see the importance of them becoming engaged and involved in their loved one's life while they're incarcerated.
I know Illinois, California, and Oregon have similar family liaison programs. How effective have they been, and have you been able to glean things from their program to apply to your work in Michigan?
I am certainly working with them now. It is something that I did a little bit of research and found the three of those. I happened to meet the woman from Illinois who is working for their Department of Corrections. They have just launched this family programming. And they, in fact, are utilizing restorative justice now as well. And that is something that I hope to do later on in the later steps of the project, working to repair and heal relationships where possible. It's not always possible. Mm. But there are many effects on families with incarceration that I think the general public maybe isn't aware of. I wasn't aware of. I used to think you do the crime, you do the time. I used to think that people were getting what they deserved. The problem was I didn't know what they were getting. And when we don't have programming in place, when we don't have family supports in place, and it's just heaped on punishment. They're set up for reoffending when this is the treatment that they've had. So I think it's really important for the general public to understand. The bottom line is we have to support people and families while they're in and help them to make sure that they're being rehabilitated, or we're just creating a vicious cycle and we're throwing away a lot of money.
And finally, Lois, how is your son doing today?
My son is doing really well. You know, it's one day at a time.
Is he out now?
He's been out for a year and a half, and it's been an amazing journey because at the last facility he was at, he was provided the treatment that he needed. He was in groups and was able to partake in the helps that he was needing to find success. It really helped to turn his life around.
That was Lois DeMott. She'll be coordinating the liaison program between prisoners, families, and officials at three Michigan prisons. And you can get more information at familyparticipationprogram.com. More women are being put behind bars in the U.S. The female prison population in this country rose 646% from 1980 to 2010, largely because of drug offenses. So what happens once these women are paroled? Jennifer Kobina is an assistant professor of criminal justice at Michigan State University, and she's lead author of a study on female parolees, a study that was published in the journal Race and Justice. Jennifer, you surveyed more than 400 women who are on probation and parole for drug crimes in Michigan. What did you learn about how they try to keep from becoming repeat offenders?
We found that women on probation and parole who lived in poor neighborhoods where crime was prevalent, they were much more likely to use isolating strategies to avoid offending compared to female probationers and parolees who lived in neighborhoods that were well off. So, for instance, we found that African Americans who lived in poor neighborhoods, they often tried to avoid everyone in order to stay out of trouble. But women who lived in better, more affluent neighborhoods, they used the strategy of spending time with law-abiding individuals. And so really, the most important thing to remember is that women who lived in neighborhoods that were well off, they used less restrictive strategies, while women who lived in poor neighborhoods that had high rates of crime, they're more likely to use restrictive strategies, which really limits their ability to fully participate in public life.
So as you heard these stories for your study, Jennifer, what ideas came to your mind for improving this, being able to improve the lives and the outcomes of female parolees, but especially the black female parolees and probationers?
Yeah, we do have a few recommendations. One, we believe that case managers, probation and parole agents, and community program staff should provide women with information on housing in safe areas. And then efforts should be made to provide placement assistance so that women can actually live in these areas. The second recommendation is on a much larger scale, and that is we believe it's important to reinvest in low-income communities and provide programs and services that would be useful in helping women who live in high-crime neighborhoods develop accessible networks. And the reason why it's important to develop accessible networks is because studies show that having ties to pro-social or positive networks has been shown to provide a disincentive to commit crimes. So that can be what women particularly need in order to reduce their risk of reoffending. And then the third recommendation we would suggest is confronting discriminatory housing policies and other barriers to living in positive community environments.
Meaning what?
I would say this. So studies show that African Americans, they tend to receive less information than whites about available housing. Also, renters and home buyers, they tend to be steered into neighborhoods with racial compositions that reflect their own race or ethnicity. And parolees often experience discrimination when it comes to securing housing because of the stigma that's often associated with having a felony record. Mm. And so all of these issues or barriers make it incredibly difficult for women in general who are on probation and parole to secure housing in safe neighborhoods.
It strikes me as I hear your ideas it's probably a tough sell, isn't it, when you consider that, let's talk about state resources and state dollars and where they're going to go. The schools need them. The roads need them. Fighting crime. I suspect that's a tough sell, and it makes me wonder what role and what challenge could be issued to churches in these neighborhoods to really make that such a focal point of their outreach.
Sure. I mean, I think churches, you know, can play a role, as well as even case managers and community program staff can play a role, too. So we would argue that it's important to coordinate, for instance, support groups for women who live in poor neighborhoods so that they can meet on a weekly or monthly basis. So having groups, for instance, would allow women to get out of the confines of their home. It would allow them to interact with one another and to build support networks. And in order to enable women to forge bonds with one another, we do believe it's important that safe and reliable transportation should be provided to women to go back and forth to programs and services and to events. And so perhaps female probationers and parolees can be given mentors. Yes, they can also be involved in church groups, church organizations who can help assist with transportation needs, really to help women to obtain new social support networks.
Do you feel these ideas could be expanded really to apply to all parolees and probationers? Are they really specific in your mind to women who are parolees and probationers?
Well, on the one hand, I would say that the recommendations can certainly be applied to both men and women who are on probation and parole who live in poor neighborhoods that have high rates of crime.
Mm-hmm.
However, on the other hand, I would say that it is some of the recommendations we provide are gender specific, particularly in attempts to try to help women develop accessible networks. I will say that studies show that relationships are much more important to women engaged who have contact with the criminal justice system. And that, in fact, criminal behavior has been found to be, it may be a result of involvement with antisocial family members, peers, or even significant others. And in general, women tend to place a high emphasis on connections with others. So women can grow positively if their connections are empowering and pro-social.
And realizing, as you say, that these social connections are so important to women makes it all the more heartbreaking if the scenario of women locking themselves in their homes away from everybody because they're afraid of that environment and what it might lead to.
Absolutely. And, you know, there can be potentially unintended consequences with that. If you're isolated by yourself, it may lead to feelings of depression,
mm-hmm.
sometimes one feels stressed, and then ultimately they may end up relying on drugs to cope. And I will say, all the women in our study, they were substance-involved women. They had used drugs at some point in time. And so we know that going back to drugs as a coping mechanism is a reality, and it may be an unintended consequence if they're certainly isolating themselves from everyone.
Much food for thought. Jennifer Kobina is an assistant professor of criminal justice at Michigan State University and the lead author of this study on female parolees that was published in the journal Race and Justice. Jennifer, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Just what is up with the building of a new bridge between Detroit and Windsor? Well, it appears the bridge is taking a backseat to politics in Lansing. As the Detroit News editorial team recently wrote, and here's the quote, "Governor Rick Snyder should not still be herding cats to get the new bridge built across the Detroit River." Much of the opposition to the new bridge continues from Republican lawmakers, even after it was assumed the new bridge was set to go. So what now? Well, Republican state senators have put in language in a transportation bill that would block the state from purchasing land for the new bridge. John Papageorge is a Republican state senator from Troy. Welcome.
It's my pleasure, Cindy.
So, Senator, why this new language to block the state from acquiring any land for the new bridge?
Well, that's not exactly what it does, but let me give you some background. The question is, do we need another bridge?
Does this language, I want to make sure we're clear on what the language is. Does it not?
Here's what the language says. The question is, it's a question of separation of powers, not really a bridge. What has been going on is our Department of Transportation has been doing work on the bridge with taxpayer money, and then billing the Canadians, and the Canadians have been repaying us.
Mm-hmm.
The question then becomes, can the Department of Transportation spend money that has not been appropriated, even though they get the money back? Now, that's not a bridge issue. That's the issue of separation of powers and whether any department can spend money that is not appropriated for that purpose.
But you can understand why it appears that you're trying, that this language is trying to block this bridge, to cut it off at the knees.
That language would block taxpayer money being used to do further things with the bridge. It does not stop Canadians from doing things.
But are the Canadians not having to work through the state because it's land on this side of the border?
Yes, but again, I'm telling you, the question is, does this affect the bridge? Absolutely, but the issue is one of separation of powers here.
Now, I know you have said very, very openly that you don't feel we need a second bridge, that the Ambassador Bridge is operating at diminished capacity. But if that's the case, why does Matty Maroon want to build a twin span?
Because his is 84 years old. He ought to build another one. He's not going to go out of business when somebody declares the bridge unsafe. He's got to build another bridge. He must understand that. He's got the abutments in place on both sides of the river.
Have you received campaign donations from Matty Maroon?
Absolutely, and I've received campaign donations ever much more from people who want the bridge.
Can you understand the perception as this resistance is kind of coalesced amongst Republican lawmakers like yourself? Can you understand the perception, as the Detroit News editorial put it, that lawmakers, particularly on the GOP side, have done Maroon's bidding for too long? What is your response to that, Senator?
That's silly. First of all, the accusation somehow it's donations that are causing us to do this. I've gotten infinitely more donations from people who want this bridge. The point is, do we need it, and what's the risk of going down this road for the next 30 years? And I am an absolute yes if somebody will show me what's the capacity is needed and that it can be paid for. That's my job.
Senator, is there a distrust of what the Canadians have promised to do?
No, there's a question of the risk involved here, and it's not being addressed.
So what comes next, Senator?
What comes next is we sit down and say, all right, guys, here's the set of questions. Let's deal with them.
Who do you sit down with?
Whoever needs to come to the table. I'm open, have been, from the very beginning. It's not that I just don't want a bridge and never mind. You want to give me the yes, answer the questions. At least address them. And as I said, coincidentally, when you decide that you're going to do something without the legislature in our system of government, it's a problem. And that's why it's become a separation of powers issue here. And it's probably going to wind up with the Attorney General, and I don't know where it goes from there.
State Senator John Papageorge of Troy, thank you for speaking with us on Stateside and explaining your position on the new bridge. It was good to have you with us, sir.
Sure.
So what is really going on here? We're joined now by Jack Lessenberry, Michigan Radio's political analyst, and Nolan Finley, editorial page editor at the Detroit News. We hear the senator say his opposition is about appropriations and the state should not be spending taxpayer money that has not been appropriated for land on the bridge, even though we know that Canada says it will repay it. Is that what's really going on here, Nolan?
Of course not. The legislature doesn't approve each and every infrastructure project. For the other thing, this is not involving state money. Canada is paying for every dime of this up front and will recollect or collect its payments through tolls on this bridge. There's no risk to the state. Canada must wonder what in the world sort of country it's dealing with. They can't even give us a new bridge. They must think they're dealing with some sort of banana republic.
Jack?
Nolan and I disagree on many issues, but on this one, he's absolutely right. Papa George is what they used to call sort of a useful, they used to talk about liberals being useful idiots for the communists. He's a useful idiot for Matty Maroon. Matty Maroon can't build a second bridge. The Canadians will never let him, and we might not for environmental reasons as well as transportation reasons. The odd thing to me about this is Republicans have always been the party of business interest. If you talk to any business person other than Matty Maroon, they'll tell you a new bridge is vital, and the place to put it is not there. Matty Maroon's bridge is something like a dozen traffic signals between it and Highway 401, which is sort of the I-75 of Canada. The new bridge would connect right up with it. Everything's in place. So this is just more silliness.
Nolan, as I mentioned in talking to the senator, your paper, the Detroit News, wrote that Governor Snyder should not still be herding cats to get this bridge built, but it appears he is. Is this part of a leadership problem for Governor Snyder, do you think?
No, I don't think so. It's often hard, even for a very effective governor, to overcome the money in politics. And a lot of money has been spent here to buy votes. Jack's right. Manny Maroon is not going to get to build the bridge. And this argument about public bridge, private bridge, every bridge in the country, nearly every bridge in the country, is built with public dollars. That's the appropriate role of government, to maintain the avenues of commerce.
Especially an international border crossing.
Exactly.
And Jack, your recent column and editorial here on Michigan Radio also takes to task the federal government. As you say, we're like that friend who never picks up the dinner tab. That hasn't moved further either, the money needed to build our own customs plaza.
Well, this is sort of humiliating, and some of this responsibility is squarely at the feet of the Obama administration, a lot of it. I don't know what Congress would do, but we're not talking about the bridge here. We're talking about our customs and immigration facility. Now, as far as I know, even Chad, even Togo, these poor third world countries pay for their own customs plaza. They pay for their own immigration facilities, and we're not even apparently willing to pay for that. We haven't really made it a priority. And I think the Canadian Transport Minister may have made a political mistake. The other day she said, this is so important to us, well, if we have to, we'll pay for the Americans customs plaza. And now that that's out on record, America may feel that, well, we can, that's another a further lever. But to me, there's something disgraceful about us sort of not doing that. We're talking about $250 million that has to be appropriated by Congress. But that, to me, is the main holdup here. I think Maroon and they will find ways to go around this latest legislative silliness.
If you just joined us, I'm speaking with Jack Lessenberry, Michigan Radio's political analyst, and Nolan Finley, who's the editorial page editor at the Detroit News, as we look at the things that are the many obstacles in the way of getting this second bridge across the river. And I like the thoughts of both of you. What do you think is next? What else do you think Republican opponents are going to try to do in Lansing to stop this bridge from being built? Nolan?
Well, I don't know how much more they need to do if we don't get some cooperation from Washington. We're asking for $250 million for these custom plazas from a federal government that didn't blink about spending $14 billion on a tunnel in Boston, built this bridge to nowhere. This is a project asking very little of the American taxpayer, but they could return a tremendous amount. I wonder where our congressional delegation is and why the Democrats in that delegation aren't pressuring the president to spend this money here.
Well, that's a good point, but it's Democrats and Republicans, and to some extent, Candace Miller, I've been told, is reluctant to help this bridge because she wants improvements for the Blue Water Bridge, and she wants that promised to her as well. But sure, the congressional delegation as a body, for the sake of Michigan, not only Michigan, but Ohio. Ohio has a fair amount of state economically in this bridge as well.
We heard the senator say he thinks this is all going to wind up with the attorney general. What your thoughts on that, Jack?
It ought to be noted that Papa George is 83 years old. He's term limited. Even John Engler probably couldn't have made him do anything. He's not an attorney. He really doesn't know what he's talking about when it comes to points of law. I have no reason to think that Nolan may have some insight that I don't, but I have no reason to think that Attorney General Bill Schuette would sort of sabotage the bridge.
Nolan?
Yeah, and I don't know if he was talking about Schuette or Holder. I expect that there's a lawsuit left in Manny Moreau, and this will go to court, but I don't see a case here. I think it's all about getting the policymakers to make good policy, which is what they're paid to do.
Do you think we'll be sitting here a year from now still talking about how to make this thing happen, or do you think it will start moving toward reality?
I don't know. I mean, I wouldn't bet one way or the other. I was surprised the federal government, given the level of pressure from Canada and the constant demand from Canada to get this done, and we're ignoring our biggest trading partner in this, something is going on here that I just don't get.
Well, I have to second that with Nolan. I don't know. I think that there should be pressure from everybody, Republicans and Democrats, on this. It seems to be again, this may be a reflection of Michigan's diminished clout in Washington, which is certainly going to be diminished more in January. It's sort of sad, but this is something of relevance. If something happened to Matty Maroon's rickety 1929 bridge, the economy here would be devastated worse than the economy was in New York by the World Trade Center by far. And this should be a top priority, and I don't know why the people in power here aren't doing more to make this happen.
Jack Lessenberry, Michigan Radio's political analyst, and Nolan Finley, editorial page editor at the Detroit News. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you, Cynthia. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Remember that spirited campaign to convince ESPN to choose Detroit as the new home for its Summer X Games? Well, ultimately, ESPN chose Austin, Texas for the Games. But the campaign and all its energy and spirit didn't vanish. It became an effort called Assemble. And now the organizers of Assemble are offering a way for new voices to become part of important policy conversations in Michigan. The kinds of conversations that will be happening this week at the Mackinac Policy Conference put on by the Detroit Regional Chamber. All kinds of good things happen on Mackinac Island for those who can afford the more than $2,700 ticket. Okay, it's just under $2,000 if you're a member of the Detroit Regional Chamber. But if you can't, maybe Assemble at Mackinac-ish is for you.
It's essentially a way for poor people like me to participate in a really important conversation.
That's Garrett Kohler, and along with Kevin Creasy, they're the creators of Assemble at Mackinac-ish. Now, Garrett, tell us about the kinds of conversations you hope will be happening at Assemble at Mackinac-ish.
Yeah, so largely there are two components of Assemble at Mackinac-ish. The first is, you know, our engagement with the Mackinac Policy Conference. So we're setting up, you know, they make their live stream available online. We're going to be setting up a compound sort of in the barn area and bringing these 60 people together to watch the live stream of some of the major policy conference sessions. And then we're going to put together formal responses. And it's essentially, hey, what was said at Mackinac that was really important from our perspective? And from our perspective, what was missing? And then what are some tangible steps to realizing the sort of vision that we think is represented by what's missing and what's important? So we're going to put out formal recommendations every day, and that's specifically around the Mackinac Policy Conference content. And then the second component is we're going to be piloting a program that we've been developing with a group called Studio Teal. And this program is called IDEA, and it's essentially predicated on the idea that you bring all these smart people into one space for a couple days But you know, there's usually the only thing that comes out of it is inspiration, right? And we're like, hey, how do we turn all these minds against one challenge and come up with something that's actionable, an actionable solution? So we're bringing up Recovery Park, a really interesting organization that's doing great community development work in Detroit. And then about 50% of the experience at Assemble Mackinosh will be working with Recovery Park to come up with a really tangible, actionable solution to a problem they're currently facing organizationally.
So inspiration and execution.
Yeah, that's the goal.
I'm wondering, I'll start with you with this, Garrett. What message do you hope your Mackinosh meeting sends to those big names in Michigan's media and politics and business who will be on Mackinac Island while you're at Charlevoix?
Well, again, this entire event was really predicated on this notion that, you know, we really believe that the one of the biggest challenges facing both Detroit and Michigan is this retention and attraction. How are we retaining the next generation of workers, of creators in Michigan? And you know, they're talking about the future of Michigan at Mackinac. But we really believe that they haven't done a really effective job of incorporating the actual future, which is, you know, younger voices. So I think that a huge win would be that, you know, they see an effective way to incorporate the younger voices who are really excited to be participating in conversations around the future of a state they want to stay in.
Kevin?
Yeah, I mean, Garrett just hit it out of the park there. I mean, really, what we learned from the X Games bid and what we're trying to do now is, what does it look like to rebuild a city and a state all around empowering the next generation of people to create change and value in their city? And so everyone's talking about it. Everyone knows it's important. But what we really want to get at is what does it look to empower those people to create that change? Because that's how you actually attract and retain. You know, people are moving away because they see opportunity and value in other markets and other cities, you know, in companies and whatnot. But what we see in Detroit is this incredible opportunity to transform all of these problems, all of these liabilities in the city, into real opportunities to build new companies, new ideas, new products, organizations, things like that. And so that's really our pitch, is imagine if we can organize all these young people together, elevate that voice, and have a serious seat at the table in rebuilding the city and the state.
Garrett Kohler and Kevin Kreese, the creators of Assemble at Mackinac. Good talking with you. Good luck.
Thanks
awesome.
So much.
Thank you.
Today's Stateside was directed by Ellie Billings. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer was Peg Watson. Contributors are Emily Fox, Chris Hattelsey, Mercedes Mejia, Omar Saoudeh, Katie Suha, and Jeff Orniak. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.